So beginning with chapter 8, text 23, yatra kale tvanavrittam avrittam chaiva yoginaha prayate yantitam kalam vakshami bharatarshapa. O best of the Bharatas, I shall now explain to you the different times at which, passing away from this world, the yogi does or does not come back. Prabhupada says here, the unalloyed devotees of the Supreme Lord, who are totally surrendered souls, do not care when they leave their bodies or by what method. They leave everything in Krishna's hands, and so easily and happily return to Godhead. But those who are not unalloyed devotees and who depend instead on such methods of spiritual realization as karma yoga, jnana yoga, and hatha yoga must leave the body at a suitable time and thereby be assured whether or not they will return to the world of birth and death. So we've already talked about this. Essentially, you know, for the devotees are dependent 100% on Krishna and more or less throw themselves at Krishna's feet, awaiting his mercy, and just try to meditate upon Krishna and serve Krishna constantly and remember Krishna as much as possible, especially by chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And in this age of Kali, that is the recommended process. And it's also Prabhupada's emphasis throughout all the purports, right? Now, for those who are not on this particular path of bhakti yoga, then you have to work with the material energy, right? You're not necessarily in the hands of Krishna. You know, for devotees, we're in the hands of Krishna, and therefore, aspects of material conditioning are minimized. It's like, for example, your astrology or something like that. You know, when you're serving Krishna, your astrology doesn't work as normally as it would because you're in Krishna's hands. You know, your life is conducted by Krishna Graha, right? Krishna's interfering with your karma. And so similarly, if you're not in Krishna's hands, then you're 100% working in material nature. And for those yogis who are trying to transcend material nature, you have to kind of work with it. Yeah? Does that make sense? And so there's a system of timing that is very helpful to sort of lift you upward towards liberation. And it's going to be described in the next verses. And as we mentioned before, you can kind of picture, say, like 5 discs or so, rotating one on top of the other like records, right? And there's like a hole, imagine there's a hole the size of a quarter in each record. And at a certain point in time, all of those holes will line up. And then you can kind of shoot through those holes upward. And there's a natural, like an updraft. Just like if you've seen like vultures, you know, like if you go riding down Highway 5 or 99 or whatever, or up in the hillsides in the foothills of the Sierras, you'll see all these vultures flying all over the place. Or let's call them eagles, right? But actually, they're vultures. You'll see hundreds of them. And so what they do is they just circle around and they ride the updraft. You know, they don't even flap their wings. They just, because when the air pushes against the hillside, you know, it lifts up. And so they like to kind of just ride in that and just sit in it. And naturally, as soon as you, you know, if you're an eagle or a vulture, as soon as you hit that updraft, it just whoosh, like an elevator. So similarly, there's a process by which if you do this yoga balenacha, if you do this bhakti mixed with yoga, this certain practice, the sat chakra yoga, which has already been described, and you've practiced the ability to move the life airs, right? And to focus the life airs in a certain way at the agya chakra, at the, this agya chakra, and then ultimately at the time of death, moving to the crown chakra, mudni, right? And then chanting the om, omitya kaksharam brahma, right? And then meditating on the Supreme Lord, you can actually exit through that yoga bala, through that power of your yoga practice and your ability to sort of push your life airs into certain chakras. You can launch yourself out like a cannon, right? You can launch yourself out at a certain time and hit through all those holes and sort of be lifted up by this updraft. Okay? And then as Krishna mentioned, you know, bhaktya, you have to mix it with bhakti. Like you also have to surrender to the Supreme Lord. You have to remember the Supreme Lord. But as we said before, the devotee, he remembers the Supreme Lord out of love. Like he's cultivated a relationship of surrender and love throughout his life. And therefore, he naturally thinks of Krishna. You know, because he's been serving Krishna for so long and absorbed in Krishna. And therefore, it's very natural for the devotee to think of Krishna. Whereas for somebody who's not necessarily a devotee like that, they've cultivated by practice certain skills, right? Certain skills and abilities of moving around their life airs and things like that. And they're going to use that to try to remember Krishna at the time of death. They're going to use that ability to focus the mind to all of a sudden grab onto Krishna at the time of death, right? And then push their life airs through, you know, and then exit basically through the crown chakra at this very particular time. Does that make sense? Okay. So Krishna says here in text 24, Agnir jyotir aha shukla shanmasa uttadayanam tatra prayati gacchanti brahma brahma vado janaha. Those who know the Supreme Brahman attain that Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery god in the light at an auspicious moment of the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. So when fire, light, day, and the fortnight of the moon are mentioned, it is to be understood that over all of them there are various presiding deities who make arrangements for the passage of the soul. At the time of death, the mind carries one on the path to a new life. If one leaves the body at the time designated above, either accidentally or by arrangement, it is possible for him to attain the impersonal Brahmajyoti. So the idea being that this is a natural updraft that leads you toward Brahman. Brahma, Brahma Vado Janaha. So you're going to go to the absolute truth. That is, of course, if you know the absolute, if you know Brahman, if you are a Brahma Vidha. Right? So if you're an individual who is conscious of Brahman, then you can attain the Brahmajyoti through this process. And so what is that process? Well, the demigod of Agni, right? The fire god. And there's some connection here to, you know, performing fire sacrifices, right? Like the Panchagni Yajna. This is also called the Devayan. Okay? And within the Vedic literatures, you'll read about the Devayan and the Pitriyan, the two different paths. So the Devayan goes towards the Brahmajyoti through the heavenly planets, and the Pitriyan is like the same path, you're going in the other direction. They're like two big roadways, right? And so the one is going towards the Pitriloka, the realm of the ancestors. That's described in the next verse. All right? And this is also mentioned in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, the Devayan and the Pitriyan. And you'll find it in the Upanishads and stuff like that. Okay? And I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's some... Anyway, I don't want to speculate, but there is some astronomical connection, you know, with the Milky Way and things like that. So, anyway, you have the demigod of fire, Agni. He hands you up to the demigod of light, Jyoti, who hands you up to the demigod of the day, Aha, who hands you up to the demigod of Shukla, which is the bright fortnight, which is when the moon is waxing, right? And then you have, finally, the demigod of the Shanmasa Uttarayanam, right? The Uttarayana demigod, who is in charge of when the sun is in when the sun is moving towards the north. Which, for us, we're in the Dakshinayanam right now. So we're not in the time to go to the heavenly planets. We're not in the time to go towards the Brahmajyoti. We're in the time, if you want to go to Pitriloka, you leave your body now, right? And you see that Bhishma Dev, he actually followed this system. Remember, he waited until the sun went into the Uttarayanam, which is a more auspicious time for that. Okay? So you find this kind of, you do find this in the Vedic literature, where the great sages are trying to leave their body when all these things are lined up. So you want to go in the Uttarayanam when the sun, after Christmas time, right? After whatever, December 25th or 26th, 27th, the sun is like at its lowest point, and then it starts moving forward again. It goes like this. Right? And so in Christmas time, the sun will be the furthest to the south, and then it starts moving north again. And so once it starts moving north, then you find when the moon is in its way, is waxing, right? And then you have to find the time, then it has to be during the daytime. And it has to be, et cetera, associated with Agni. You know, there's like fire sacrifices involved, right? And then you travel north, then you leave your body through that process, like satisfying these deities, and they carry you upward. Does that make sense? Okay.
Devotees don't really think about all this stuff.
No, you should. No, I'm just joking. No. No, devotees don't worry about it. And that's kind of what Prabhupada is saying in the previous purport, right? They leave everything in Krishna's hands. So mystics who are advanced in yoga practice can arrange the time and place to leave the body. Others have no control. If by accident they leave at an auspicious moment, then they will not return to the cycle of birth and death, but otherwise there's every possibility that they will have to return. So, you know, there could be a grandma driving her car and she, you know, goes on the black ice and ends up, you know, in a creek or something and she dies, you know, but it just happens to be the right time. She could potentially go to the Brahmajyoti. Right? She could actually be carried upward by the force of these aspects of nature. Of course, you know, for to go to the Krishna's abode, then you have to actually worship the Supreme Lord. It can't just happen by accident. But Prabhupada mentions here, if by accident. So there is the possibility of leaving, you know, at a very auspicious moment, right? In fact, even if you look in astrology, there's a whole system of timing things called muhurta, you know, where you try to, it's actually quite difficult. Like, I'm familiar with muhurta, and so when you're timing, when you're trying to find an auspicious time, it's like, you know, there's only like one good one every 6 months or something like it. It's to actually find something where all these auspicious things line up. It's extremely rare. It's extremely difficult. But those are the different, that's what's used to determine when to do yajnas and things like that. You know, more like karmakan things. Or any kind of material activity. Of course, Vaishnavas will put more emphasis on Krishna, right? Krishna's festival days of Krishna, appearance days of Krishna, appearance days of Acharyas, those are considered more the auspicious times. Okay? But just materially speaking, these things have an effect, you know? And it's usually lined up with your karma. Like if you, say for example, you're going to open your business and you want to do it at a very auspicious moment, which is good, then, you know, if you don't know anything about Mahorta and you don't pay somebody to do it or whatever, then it's basically completely up to your karma, right? You may or may not accidentally open your business at an auspicious moment. But that will have a lot of effect on how your business runs and everything like that. So, you know, it's basically you will or will not have the karma for it to happen at an auspicious moment. But it's spiritually speaking, when it comes to leaving the body, there are these auspicious, quote-unquote, muhurtas, you know, are times which are very good, and you may even accidentally hit one. Okay? But as you're pointing out, you know, devotees don't really worry about it. You just kind of leave yourself in Krishna's hands. And Prabhupada says that here. However, for the pure devotee in Krishna consciousness, there's no fear of returning, whether he leaves the body in auspicious or an inauspicious moment, by accident or by arrangement. Okay? Any questions about this? All right. Yes?
Does that go the same with if you leave your body during like Ekadashi and things like that? Does that have to do with the muhurtas and things like that?
You mean like whether it's auspicious or inauspicious?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there's not much you can do about leaving your body. The point is that everything is by divine arrangement. Right, everything is by either the will of the Supreme Lord or the will of the gods. You know, like for example, in astrology, you can cast a death chart for somebody, like when they die, and then you can see certain things, like when, you know, whether the supreme, you know, what kind of was there special mercy upon them by some particular deity. You can see that, you know. So there's all sorts of different things you can see, but the point is, it's all being orchestrated ultimately by the Supersoul. Right? I mean, there's different deities that are in charge, as we're hearing here. Dumo Ratri Stata Krishna, Sanmasa Dakshanayanam, that's the next verse. There's different deities that are in charge of all these things, but ultimately behind it all you have the divine will of Krishna. And therefore for devotees that takes prominence over all these other things, over these other sort of arrangements by lesser deities. Okay? But whether or not leave your body on a Ekadashi or something like that, you know, that doesn't really factor in. You know, that's not so important. Ekadashi, or, you know, that's not your... Here it's these specific deities that are in charge of these particular scales of time or these periods of time, and then they will lift you upwards. Okay? You don't see Ekadashi mentioned, huh? So, I mean, I guess it's auspicious. You know, for devotees, though, the auspicious thing is wherever there's Krishna, you know. If devotees are chanting, if devotees are, you're sitting there leaving your body and everyone's doing kirtan, then that's auspicious no matter what the external timing may be. Okay? All right, let's take a look at text 25. Dhumo ratri stita krishna sanmasa dakshanayanam tatra chandramasam jyotir yogi prapya nivartate. The mystic who passes away from this world during the smoke, the night, the fortnight of the waning moon, or the 6 months when the sun passes to the south, reaches the moon planet, but again comes back. So both of these are temporary. They're like boomeranging out, you know. You may, through your pious activities, through performing Pancha Mahayagya, or even, as Prabhupada says here, by accident, you know, you may actually go upward through the Devayan. You may actually go through the path of the gods, essentially. And it goes as far as the Brahma Jyoti. You could even be liberated, which is pretty far out. So, you know, and there's all sorts of stops along the way, right? Like Prabhupada mentioned previously that the sannyasis can go to even to Brahma's abode. You know, so there's all sorts of, just like you have this train line, you know, coming right here. What is it called? The Expo line or something? So you may go all the way to Santa Monica and to the beach, or you may only get to Palms. Wah, 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 right? So it's the same thing, you know. You have this kind of Devayan goes all the way up to the Brahma Jyoti, but it passes through Brahma's abode and through all the different heavenly planets, right? And then this one, it's almost like, you know, that's literally, like we say, the Expo line. That's what Devayan means. It's like the Deva line, yeah? And then you have the Pitri line, which is this one just being described here. And it's the final stop is Pitri Loka. You don't want to fall asleep, right? You fall asleep and miss your stop and you end up in Pitri Loka, you know? Last call, and the guy, you know, comes to the train and wakes you up, you know, where am I? Oh, you're in Pitri Loka, right? And the train's going to take off from the station and turn around at Yamaraj's abode and, like, you know, make its way back or something. So, huh? Yeah, right. Yamaraj's abode. That's exactly. It's going the other way, right? The further you go that way, right? That's, in Skid Row, that's Narkaloka, right? So that's kind of like, you know, we can visualize it like this, right? And so, you know, these great sages and things like that, they're traveling on this Devayan, right? Like if you look up into the sky and see, you know, the Milky Way or whatever it is, you know, that's, of course, the Ganges, right? The celestial Ganges. You know, you could, with celestial vision, you would see, you know, thousands of sages traveling upward to the Devayan, right? And then you see the ancestors traveling through the sky to the Pitriyan, right? So, of course, I'm not saying that's exactly how it happens. I'm just, use your imagination, you know? There's these two pathways that lead from this world. And once you travel through them, you again come back. You know, once your karma's exhausted, you return to this particular world. This is karma kshetra. This is the realm of karma. This is the realm of fruit of action. It's where the mode of passion is a constant. And so whatever actions you perform here, you get your ticket for whatever train you're riding on. You know, it'll take you as far as you can pay. It's like when you buy a train ticket, you know, like I know in the Bay Area you have like the BART train, and you go and you put how much money, you know, and you figure out which, they have like a graph, and you figure out what station you're going to, you know, Union Station or whatever, and then, it, you know, you follow the line, it says $2.50, you know, and then the next station is $2.75, and the next station is $3, right? So, you know, how many yajñas did you perform? How much sacrifice did you do? What's your particular qualification? That's how much money you get on your BART card, your BART ticket, right? You get the full $7, you can go to a Colma or something, right? You go to the end of the line, okay? And if you're very, very advanced, you may even go to the Brahma Jyoti. It's like the final destination, all right? So so as it says here, the dhumo, you know, the smoke. And again, this is related to these different types of yajñas and things, which I don't fully understand. It's like the Karmakan system. And then, you know, the deity of the night, it's very much the opposite of the Devayan. The deity of the night passes you up to the deity of the dark fortnight, right? Which is when the moon is in decline. It's moving towards the new moon. It's traveling towards the sun, essentially. Like when you have here you have the sun. When the moon is lined up with the sun, that's the new moon. And then it starts traveling away, and when it's opposite the sun, that's the full moon. And then it starts traveling back to the sun. It's shrinking again, right? It's getting smaller. So that's the dark fortnight, is when the moon is shrinking. And then finally, when the six months when the sun is moving to the south, and that's right now. We're in, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's inauspicious, but it's certainly less auspicious. right? The Dakshinayanam is considered of a lesser level of auspiciousness. Okay? All right. So, Prabhupada mentions here, in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Kapila Muni mentions that those who are expert in fruitive activities and sacrificial methods on earth attain to the moon at death. These elevated souls live on the moon for about 10,000 years by demigod calculations and enjoy life by drinking somaras. They eventually return to earth. This means that on the moon there are higher classes of living beings, though they may not be perceived by the gross senses. Anyway, and in the different planetary systems, essentially it doesn't, just because you don't, you know, you may be able to travel there in a spacecraft or not, just because you don't see any life forms doesn't mean that there's not, it's not living entities in a higher dimension of existence, right? If you go to the dark side of the moon or something like that, then just because, you know, it looks like rocks and stones and there's nothing there, that's just because you're in a human body, and the human body is really encapsulated in a certain level of consciousness. Like, you can only perceive the universe from a certain perspective, the human perspective, right? Like, if you're in the body of a god, and this is, you know, again, this is sort of like the Vedic way of looking things. If you're in the body of a god, you see the universe totally different, you know? Like, if you look in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, there's all these different, it's like a strange picture of the universe, you know, the flat earth or whatever. It's not even really a flat earth. It's like a, you know, giant disk, and there's Mount Mandada in the middle, right? And there's all the different kind of like circular expansions moving outward from that, Bhumandala. And so, you know, why don't we see that? Well, that's not necessarily what the way that our particular form of existence perceives reality. You know, we see reality from a totally different perspective, where within the earth body, our consciousness is confined to perceiving reality through the physical body of a human being. Whereas if you're in the body of a god, you're going to see reality much different. The whole world is going to look different to you. And so if you go, you know, to these other different planetary systems, you know, there may be other living entities there who are on a more subtle level of existence. Like, you're just, when you perceive the moon or the dark side of the moon or whatever it may be, then you're only looking at kind of the human moon. You know, you're looking at the human perspective of the moon, which isn't really the whole moon. There's like, if you were to revisit the moon as a demigod, you would see a totally different thing. You know? So, let's take a look here at text 26. Shukla krishne gatihyete jagata shashvate mate ekaya yatyana vrittam anyaya vartate punaha. According to the Vedic opinion, there are two ways of passing from this world, one in light and one in darkness. When one passes in light, he does not come back, but when one passes in darkness, he returns. So the same descriptions of departure and return is quoted by Acharya Baladeva Dibhushan from the Chandogya Upanishad 5.10.3-5. Those who are fruitive laborers and philosophical speculators from time immemorial are constantly coming and going. Actually, they do not attain the ultimate salvation, for they do not surrender to Krishna. Okay, so this is that Chandogya Upanishad verse that was mentioned previously, and that's where it's describing the Panchamaha Yajna. Or Panchagni Yajna, sorry. Panchamaha Yajna is different. Panchagni Vidya is what Prabhupada calls it in the purport of text 16. So it's kind of this system. Basically, that's the one, again, where it describes the, you know, you perform different sacrifices and then you kind of lift it upwards into the heavenly planets and you come back down again through the rain, which is eaten by living beings and turned into semen, which is then, you know, injected into the female of the species, and you again take birth in that way. So there's a way in which the demigods fall and a way in which the demigods rise. Yeah? And you rise through these different sacrifices, the Panchagni Vidya. Yeah.
Is it true if when you die, your soul comes out through your mouth?
Well, I mean, I'm not exactly sure like how the soul comes out. But from my understanding from this chapter, the soul can leave in all sorts of ways, especially like through the chakras, you know, like through the crown chakra. That's the way the yogis choose to exit. From what I've heard, which again, it's not like substantiated by anything I've heard from Prabhupada or anything like that, but, you know, you can leave from other chakras too, like your root chakra or whatever. Like the soul, you know, that's a pretty low, that's like a low birth, you know, like coming out the bottom, right? So that's like a less valuable form, a less prestigious exit hole, So anyway, anyway, I'll stop making jokes right now. I can go for the rest of the class in this direction. So anyway, but as far as the soul leaving the mouth, like, you know, you'll find in sci-fi and stuff like that, I don't know about that. Okay, let's take a look at text 27. And by the way, you know, you can look these up, where it says the Chandogya Upanishad, 5:10, 3-5. So let's take a look at text 27. Naiti sriti parta janan yogi muhyati kashchana tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yogo yukto bhavarjuna. Although the devotees know these two paths, O Arjuna, they are never bewildered, therefore be always fixed in devotion. So this is Krishna's conclusion. You know, the devotees don't really care about the Devayan or Pitriyan, right? The devotees or the yogis, as is being said here, and the ultimate yogi is the devotee, right? Prabhupada says here, yoga yukta, is one engaged in Krishna consciousness. So for the devotees, then they're not really interested in traveling up with the Devayan or Pitriyan. Okay? They just depend upon the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada says here, Krishna is here advising Arjuna that he should not be disturbed by the different paths the soul can take when leaving the material world. A devotee of the Supreme Lord should not worry whether he will depart by arrangement or by accident. The devotee should be firmly established in Krishna consciousness and chant Hare Krishna. He should know that concern over either of these two paths is troublesome. The best way to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness is to be always dovetailed in his service, and this will make one's path to the spiritual kingdom safe, certain, and direct. So just put yourself in Krishna's hands, always be rendering service, right? Prabhupada says here, it's the best way to be absorbed in Krishna is to be dovetailed in his service. I can speak quite frankly with you that, you know, those devotees who do service are the devotees who end up doing good, right, doing well. If you find devotees who don't do service and they're not really connected to Krishna in that way, it's just not the same. Like, they're not really firmly fixed. Oftentimes it doesn't turn out, their spiritual lives don't turn out as nicely as devotees that are willing to surrender and do some service and do it consistently and be responsible for Krishna. Right? There's a certain attitude that's there. You know, there's a certain, I mean, just to speak sort of broadly in a way that's easy to understand. You find some devotees that have a very humble attitude and that are sort of submissive towards, you know, towards their guru and towards spiritual authority and are trying to somehow please Krishna through that process and are willing to take up something, even if it's very small, and just be consistent with it and try to serve Krishna through that. Those devotees, their path is glorious, right? You can really see that they gradually develop very healthy in spiritual life. And it really comes from that attitude and that willingness to do service. Whereas you see devotees that aren't, right? Devotees that either avoid doing service or, you know, basically their spiritual lives are not rooted in doing something for Krishna. And maybe they just like to sit around and give their opinion or something like that. Right, that's generally their spiritual lives wither up, right? Or devotees that if they're doing service, all they do is complain that they have to do service or something like that, right? Or they feel begrudgingly they have to do service. They don't recognize that it's service to Krishna, right? Like, they don't really see that service to Krishna is very valuable. They see it as like a drudgery or a burden, and they avoid it as much as possible. They're going to have serious trouble in their spiritual life. They're not going to go very far. It's just like a plant, you know, trying to somehow take root on a boulder where there's no earth, you know what I mean? And they're just like grabbing onto a boulder and the wind comes and blows it right off. Like, if you really want to get your roots deep, then try to do something for Krishna. Because Krishna feels obliged to you, right? The Guru Parampara, if you do something for Krishna and you do some regular service, then the Guru Parampara reciprocates and you get mercy. And Krishna will give you the understanding by which you can come to him, yeah? He'll enlighten you from within. He'll give you the knowledge by which you can approach him. But you see, any kind of relationship you develop with somebody, it's always one of exchange, right? Like, if you want someone to love you, then you have to do something for them. Like, you have to, if you want to develop a relationship of love with someone, you can't just demand it. You can't just, you know, oh, why doesn't this person love me? You know, why don't they love me? Why aren't you totally devoted to me when you've never actually done anything? It's an absurd way to approach somebody. You have to actually approach with the right attitude. Tadvidi panipatena pariprashnena sevaya, right? You have to approach with humility and service. And when you approach Krishna through that path of humility and service, then you become very strong over time in spiritual life. But if you don't, if you simply, you know, sort of basically, we'll let that beautiful sound pass. So if you don't, and you just sort of like whimsically, whatever, approach Krishna consciousness, then you're not going to really have firm roots, right? There's not going to be that level of reciprocation with Krishna. You know? Does that make sense? It's kind of like if you really do something serious for Krishna and you devote yourself to Krishna and you have some project or anything, it could even just be something small that you do for Prabhupada, then there's some special grace upon you, right? And when you go through difficult times or whatever, right, there's help that's there. Krishna will not let you go. You may be even like a rascal. You may even be you may have problems in spiritual life, but if you really, really sacrifice all the time and do things for Krishna, Krishna will really help you. It's just, it's a very real thing, right? But if you don't do service, then, or if your attitude towards service is like, you always make me do service, you know? Like if you don't really appreciate and understand the value of it, then you're going to have some serious problems in your spiritual life. You're not going to be able to approach properly. Yeah?
Sometimes I notice, like in my service, sometimes I have to like beat my mind up. It's like another part of my mind. Like part of my mind is like, I don't want to go out. And there's another part of my mind where I can have to jump over that part of my mind. Is that like a normal thing?
Yeah, of course.
You need to go through like where you like, it's like a barrier that you have to get through. You almost have to jump over that barrier in order to progress through your service. But once I get over that barrier, I feel like a lot of reciprocation.
Exactly.
And like sometimes I feel like guilty that I'm even having that feeling.
Well, anyway, it's normal because we're in the lower modes of nature, right? Mm-hmm. And the lower modes of nature, especially the mode of ignorance, doesn't want to do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's normal. But some devotees choose to do it anyway, mm-hmm. and some devotees don't. Right, so it's that choice to do it anyway. That's really where your devotion is expressed. Right, so like for example, you know, like I say in my service, it's like I don't want to go in the, you know, it's like maybe I have to spend a whole bunch of hours in the kitchen doing a whole bunch of stuff, you know, preparing for a festival or whatever, right? Something for the deities, and I got to deal with like so much garbage, and you know, and I don't want to go into that kitchen, and I don't want to do it. You know, but then it's like, well, I got to do it, and I got to like get ready, okay, and even psych myself up. Okay, here I go, you know. All right, it's time to go, you know, here I go. Like sometimes it's like you enter in there, and it's like a whirlwind of just people talking to you, and this problem, and that problem, and this thing. And, you know, this is like managerial stuff, right? Or any kind of festival, or say you're like managing a Rath Yatra or whatever. You know, as soon as you step out into the public, it's just from all directions, you know, fire over here, fire over there, there's this problem and that thing, and there's this issue and that and this, and just people running up to you and calling you, and it's just like this wild, crazy thing. And so you feel in the beginning like, oh my God, you know, I don't want to, but I got to take the plunge, you know, I'm just going to jump in and do it anyway, right? And so there's always that element of just jumping in and doing what you don't want to do, you know, but that's really where the surrender is. That's really where the sacrifice is. And as you said, that's where the reciprocation is, right? And the more difficult it is, oftentimes the more the reciprocation.
Yeah.
Like the more you don't want to do it and you do it anyway, then you'll find Krishna is very merciful. And and I mean, that's there in any position in life, you know, even if like your family or whatever, you have children or, you know, you have a job or whatever, you have to do that anyway. Even if you're working a job, yeah, you don't want to do it, but you got to do it anyway. You just, every morning, you got to get up and do it anyway. So, you know, and even if for people that are working jobs, then you have to do that for Krishna too, right? That's your book distribution, you know, like going to your office, that's your book distribution, dealing with that jerk at work, right? And when I'm speaking in singular, but there's probably plural, you know, it's probably like at least five or six jerks that you can't really stand. And it's like you want to just run from the battlefield every time they come towards you, right? and you want to just get the heck out of there. But, you know, you recognize this is my duty, I'm going to do it for Krishna, and you just sort of plunge in and do it anyway. And then that's how you become purified. You know, Krishna will reciprocate with that too. That's the point. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And otherwise, you know, even if you want to be materially successful, you have to do that anyway. Right? Of course, Krishna doesn't necessarily reciprocate with that, you know, but if you're a materialist, then when, you know, why do you think the manager or the CEO or whoever, why do you think they get paid the big bucks? Well, because they do all the stuff that's really, really difficult, like, you know, having to deal with people and all sorts of crazy stuff and, you know, having basically to do things that they don't want to do. That's really how you become responsible. That's how you become, that's how in material life, that's how you gain status and position. Right, it's not just a question of like, you know, you want to be the big guy at work. It's not just that you step in and everyone just sees, wow, look, he's shining like the sun. There he is, you know, make him the king, right? Then the whole office offers obeisances. It's not really how it works. It's those individuals who are willing to do what has to be done and who are willing to take huge amounts of crap. Right, and are willing to basically struggle through and push through all the difficulties, no matter what. You know, then those are the individuals that eventually rise to positions of responsibility. Right, so that's even in material life. That's what gives success. Utsahan nishchaya dharya tatat karma pravartana sangat tagat tato vritte. So you have to have utsahan, enthusiasm. You have to have patience. You have to have confidence, right? But you have to have like this dridhavrat, this determination to just do it no matter what. You know, you have to have that intensity of focus that I'm going to serve Krishna no matter how difficult it gets. And there'll be huge challenges to that because it can get very difficult. And I don't mean, you know, cooking sabji is difficult, or, you know, even book distribution can be difficult. But what I mean is just like the challenges that you'll face in spiritual life, the overwhelming challenges. Yeah.
Most of the challenges I find, they don't necessarily come from external conditions, they come from within
us. Sure. Yeah, so, I mean, certainly. But just speaking of external conditions, you'll find tremendous amounts of just the ugliness of the world. You know, like as you move through in life and you see kind of like the skin of reality is pulled back and you see the bare bones of what reality is, it's not a pleasant thing. And you have to serve Krishna in the midst of that. Mm-hmm. You know, and you look at, like, say, someone like Srila Prabhupada, you know, we tend to think of Srila Prabhupada as like, you know, okay, he's this great acharya and somehow he comes into the situation and all the doors open and miracles happen. It's not like that. You know, Prabhupada struggled tremendously, even with his disciples. I mean, you can think there's like, how difficult must it be to take someone in spiritual life and over like decades sort of raise them up from nothing and really give them everything and water them like a plant and care for them and empower them and pray for them and love them, and then to have them like stab you in the back or something, or declare themselves the acharya, or, you know what I mean? And this is the type of thing that spiritual masters have to experience. So even like those great souls that are, you know, taking on responsibility as spiritual masters, they experience like ugliness and disturbances and hardships and some of the most difficult experiences you can imagine, right? But because there's that determination to serve Krishna, they're willing to push through it and serve anyway. And so that's really what's needed. Like, no matter how ugly the world gets, no matter how difficult it gets, no matter how disturbing, and no matter how great the challenge is, no matter how impossible the task looks, if you're willing to somehow stay there and try to do that for Krishna, then that's where the mercy comes. And you see that's what Srila Prabhupada did, right? Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati gave him an impossible task in their very first meeting. You know, go preach in the Western world in English. And at the time, you know, you couldn't buy a plane ticket, right? So this is an impossible task. It's basically like suicide. You know, a 70-year-old man is going to go across the ocean and never come back, right? And just with a trunk of books, you know, and he's going to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, right? With just a trunk of books, and he's having heart attacks on the way and things like that. So, I mean, this is just an impossible task. Right? You know, like we walk across the street and we stub our toe and it's like, that's it for the day, you know? We're finished, you know? I did all I can do for Krishna, you know? But you see, Srila Prabhupada is like, you know, having heart attacks, multiple heart attacks on the way to New York or Boston. And he's still determined to serve Krishna. He's still going, right? Till his last breath, he's going to try to fulfill the order of his spiritual master. And because he has that level of determination, therefore Krishna reciprocates, right? And you'll see with the, like when Prabhupada was in Mumbai and in Delhi, he's trying to distribute back to Godheads. Right, and he's an old man in blazing heat. He has sunstroke. He's being gored by a bull. You know, there's like nobody's buying it at all. Right, he's all alone. Right, he's all alone there, printing his own books, printing his own magazines, you know, doing anything he can to get paper, right, which is difficult on its own. Arranging all the printing by himself, and you know, putting all the pamphlets together. Everything he's doing himself, and then he's going out in the street and just like. Asking people who are just so, you know, negative towards him, you know, get out of here, you know, I don't want it. Going into tea stalls and stuff like that and being rejected. And he did this for like a decade, you know. He just continually does it and does it and does it, no matter how difficult it gets, no matter how impossible it is. He's just trying to serve the order of his guru. Even though there's no result, right? Even though it's just, it's an absurdity, right? And so that's the kind of determination, that's what it means, determination. Right? It's not just, you know, I'm going to do it. No, it's like, no matter how horrible it is, no matter how horrific this world is and how impossible the task may be, I'm going to keep pushing ahead no matter what for the service of my guru in Krishna. You see? And when you have that level of determination, and no matter what, you hold that level of determination, then Krishna will shower his mercy upon you completely. And you see, that's what Krishna did with Prabhupada. As he showered this unlimited mercy, and Prabhupada is able to do the impossible, right? It is basically a miracle to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. No one thought it possible. His god brothers, nobody thought it possible, right? Like that's not even like a dream that goes into your mind. Like back in that time, if you would have thought, oh yeah, you know, maybe I'll go around the world and spread Krishna consciousness, it would just be like a joke, you know, like a crazy daydream that you have, you know. Nobody take it serious, you know. Maybe one god brother went to London for a little bit and, you know, preached to some people, and that was like a great victory, you know. But spreading it around the world, you know, that's just like a pipe dream, right? But Prabhupada actually did it by the grace of Krishna, right? Prabhupada didn't do it like, you know, by his power he went out and did it. No, he just threw himself at the feet of Krishna and was willing to serve his guru's order with no matter what, no matter how difficult it is, no matter what opposition, even to the point of death and beyond. And because that level of determination, Krishna looks at that and says, oh, I have to fulfill that desire, right? I have to reciprocate with this devotee. This devotee is, you know, wild, you know, like he's just throwing himself at my feet, you know, he's just like throwing himself out there and to serve me, then I have to fulfill his desire. So that's the level that's needed, okay? So we have to really understand, again, as Prabhupada says here, the best way to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness is to be always to be dovetailed in Krishna's service. So we have to surrender to the order of the spiritual master. Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kudanandana. Okay? Prabhupada says here, the word yoga yukta is especially significant in this verse. One who is firm in yoga is constantly engaged in Krishna consciousness in all his activities. Srila Rupa Goswami advises, anasaktasya vishayan ittaharam upayunjataha. One should be unattached in material affairs and do everything in Krishna consciousness. By this system, which is called yukta vairagya, one attains perfection. Okay, so this is also how Prabhupada defines that utsahan, that enthusiasm. And then nectar of instruction verse, that this enthusiasm means to like look at the world and see how it can be engaged in Krishna's service, right? That's how, you know, look at like Prabhupada's eye, you know, like what is Prabhupada's, how does he see the world? What is he looking at when he's looking around? He's simply looking how everything can be dovetailed in Krishna's service, right? That's kind of how he approached the world, isn't it? You know, like remember when he was on the Jaladuta and he was going into Boston Harbor and he wrote that song, right? And he's looking at it and saying, they're in passion and ignorance. I don't know how this can be done, you know, but if you desire, my Lord, then, you know, it can be done. And so, but he's thinking constantly, you know, how am I going to engage all of them in Krishna's service? And so that's what we inherit from Prabhupada, is that not only that ability, that intelligence to engage everything in Krishna service, but that determination. You see, this is a gift that's given to us, is that you have the right, first of all, to use everything in Krishna service, you know, under reasonable authority. You have the right to engage the world in Krishna service. But you also, you know, have the intelligence, you have the guidance to do it. And finally, you know, our Guru Parampara is giving you the determination to do it, the enthusiasm to do it. Right? So we should accept that gift. It shouldn't be like, you know, I don't want to do any service, you know. You should be, whatever, but I don't want to get into it all. But you find so much like antagonism towards this mood of actually doing service. That's a complete backward way of looking at things, you know, not recognizing the gift that you've been given in the form of service and feeling it's like a burden. Okay? Prabhupada says, therefore, the devotee is not disturbed by these descriptions because he knows that his passage to the supreme abode is guaranteed by devotional service. Let's take a look at the last verse. Vedeshu yajneshu tapasu chaiva danesha yat punya palam pradishtam atyati tat sarvamadam vaditva yogi param sthanam upayati chadyam. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing austere sacrifices, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end he reaches the supreme eternal abode. So again, Krishna here is glorifying the yogi, right? Yogi yukto bhavarjuna, the yogi, and again, Prabhupada's emphasizing here the devotee, because the devotee is the highest form of yogi. Yoginam api sarvesham madgatenantat atmana. That's when Krishna says yogi, that's what he means, right? He's already defined who's the greatest yogi. Yoginam api sarvesham madgatenantat atmana shadavan bhajate yomam. Those who worship Krishna with complete faith and devotion. And so those people don't care about leaving their body at this particular time and traveling in these different mystical paths. Rather, they just surrender to Krishna and depend upon Krishna. And for those individuals, Vedeshu yajneshu tapasu chaiva, daneshu yat punya palam pradishtam. So all of these things are available to them simply by performing devotional service. Like they automatically receive the results that are there. You look at, you know, like if you take it in the context of these two paths, it's kind of like, you know, the devotees don't have to worry because all the results of all these different yajnas and mystic processes of rising through the universe, these are already there for the devotee, right? The devotee doesn't have to worry about studying the Vedas so much or doing different yajnas or doing tapasya or giving charity because all of that is there within their devotional service. All the result of that. You just have to serve Krishna, Saiva Dharma and Parityaja, and then everything that is available in other paths is automatically within that path. Right? Like sometimes, I know with myself, sometimes like you know, there's ample opportunity to give dana, to give charity in Los Angeles, right? Like every stoplight you go to, there's somebody there, you know, and they're asking for charity, or every Albertsons you walk out of or whatever, there's somebody there asking for charity, or Target, right? So they're not always the most polite at Target. So you come out, and you know, and I'm, at least myself, I kind of feel like, you know, wow, you know, I wish I could give them some money or something, right? And sometimes, and you know, devotees, of course, can give charity in various ways, you know, where they go into how devotees can give charity in Krishna consciousness. But the point is, sometimes it's like I feel a little bit grudged, you know, like, oh my God, you know, like, boy, if I wasn't a devotee, I'd probably be more charitable, you know, I would just give people money, you know, here's $20, here's $10, here's $5, and just give out money, you know, and feel real good, right? You'd feel real good about yourself, you know, I'm very pious, right? Punya palam pradishtam. You know, like I'm being a good person. But because I'm a devotee, I can't necessarily do that. I have to consider, you know, was this person going to use the money to buy meat? Are they going to buy alcohol? Like, I can't just freely give charity to anybody, right? I have to be careful and intelligent how I give charity. I have to give it in the mode of goodness or in transcendence. So, therefore, there's a feeling like, you know, I'm missing an important part of life, right? I'm not just being as charitable as I would like to be. But that's not true. That's a lack of faith. Because within devotional service, all the results of charity and all the punya, all that punya palam pradishtam, all the fruits you would want from being a good person, right? All of that is automatically in your devotional service. Like here I am serving Krishna, but I'm thinking, you know, why, if I wasn't a devotee, I'd probably be a better person because I'd be giving charity. No, it just means that I don't see the value of devotional service. I don't see how great it is. I don't see how pure it is, how powerful it is. I don't see that it's the highest form of charity. Does that make sense? So really, we have to be able to see the glories of devotional service and see how it's at the pinnacle of charity. It's at the pinnacle of knowledge and Vedic study. It's at the pinnacle of sacrifice and mystic processes, right? It's at the pinnacle of performing tapasya and austerity. It's the very highest form of all of these things. And therefore, all of these things are naturally within it. Okay? Yeah?
What we call voluntary compliance to what we're doing.
Hmm?
We're voluntary or compliance to our services in the movement.
How do you mean? Do you want to explain? Like what's...
We're volunteers, right?
Sure.
And then we're compliant to our service. And then when we go out to the material world, we just don't give out charity. We'll give them books or some prasadam.
Well, there are ways of giving charity, of course, you know, in Krishna consciousness. Like, for example, usually I'll just go buy somebody something and then I'll offer it as prasadam, you know. Or, you know, there's different ways of doing it that you can give people charity and devotional service. But the point is that, you know, and it's not that, you know, if you're just doing service to Krishna, you're not charitable or something. You can be charitable and do service to Krishna. But the point is that sense of lack, you know, like, oh, there's something missing in devotional service, right? Like I'm not engaged in doing these yajnas, or I'm not engaged in giving charity, you know, because I'm a devotee, or, you know, I'm not, somehow because I've given my life to Krishna and I'm serving Krishna, I'm missing something else, right? It's not that you can't be charitable because you're a devotee. You can be. Maybe you just have to do it with your intelligence and according to Shastra, right? But sometimes in devotional service, there may be a fear that I'm missing something in life. I'm not getting the big picture of life. I'm not doing something important that I should be doing, right, by serving Krishna. But Krishna's saying no, that within devotional service is everything else. It's the highest pinnacle of all these things. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's take a look here at... we've kind of run out of time, but I kind of wanted to point out. Look at the third paragraph. It says, the words idam viditva indicate that one should understand the instructions given by Sri Krishna in this chapter and in the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. One should try to understand these chapters not by scholarship or mental speculation, but by hearing them in association with devotees. Okay, so this is this idam viditva. Being mentioned, atyati tat sarvam idam viditva, then you understand it not by mundane scholarship, but essentially by what we're doing right now, right? You have to study the Bhagavad Gita in the association of devotees. You have to understand the Bhagavad Gita, not just by reading it. I mean, that's nice, and Prabhupada's there, he's in the purports, but really you have to associate with those who are practicing it, right? You have to learn in the association of those who are practically applying it. That's the important thing. Okay. Prabhupada says here, just jump ahead to the last paragraph. Prabhupada says, one who has a little faith in Bhagavad Gita should learn Bhagavad Gita from a devotee, because in the beginning of the fourth chapter, it is stated clearly that the Bhagavad Gita can be understood only by devotees. No one else can perfectly understand the purpose of the Bhagavad Gita. So bhakti mam, what is it? I'm sorry. Bhakto si me sakachati rahasyam hi tuduttamam. Right? Only the devotees can understand this secret. And that's why Prabhupada's purports are so powerful. Right? I remember, like, before I was a devotee, I'd read Bhagavad Gita. Like when I was a teenager, I got it out of the library, and it wasn't Prabhupada's Gita, but it really didn't even make sense. You know, it was just like, it was just like some poetry, you know, like some kind of archaic old English style, you know, poetry and whatever. It was supposed to be some reverential text, you know. Wow, this is so amazing, you know. We don't understand what it's talking about, but it's amazing, right? It's some ancient text. It's incredible. But with Prabhupada's Gita, it's immediately, as soon as you start reading it, the purports make it very clear. Prabhupada's a devotee, and therefore he's able to give it. Bhakto si me sakacheti rahasyam hetudutamam, the secret. Because Bhagavad Gita is a secret. And so what's actually there, you can't penetrate it by your own ability. You have to actually be guided into it. It's a secret. The knowledge of what's there has to be explained. by one who's actually blessed by Krishna with the ability to explain it. In other words, a devotee or a friend of Krishna, like Arjuna. Okay, so that's why Bhagavad Gita as it is so powerful. There's so many Bhagavad Gitas that have been made, but only the Bhagavad Gita as it is transforms the lives of thousands of people, you know, every day, right? Prabhupada says here, one should therefore learn Bhagavad Gita from a devotee of Krishna, not from mental speculators. This is a sign of faith. When one searches for a devotee and finally gets a devotee's association, one actually begins to study and understand Bhagavad Gita. Okay? Let's look at the last sentence or so. This highest perfectional stage of life enables the devotee to be transferred to Krishna's abode in the spiritual sky, Goloka Vrindavan, where the devotee becomes eternally happy. And that's really what this chapter is about. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports to the 8th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita and the matter of attaining the Supreme. Thank you very much. All glories, Prabhupada.